Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD. I'm your host, Bob Hayes. Today is Friday, the 4th of November, 2005, and this is the preview show for the last MotoGP race of the season at Valencia. It's a very sad day, but still fun race. We do have a few cool items today, including some news, of course. The Valencia preview, a little bit about Valencia. The second part of our way cool interview with Brian Drebber from Speed TV, which continues the first part that was last week. So if you missed last week's show, you need to download it and listen to that first part of Brian Drebber's interview. And then we'll finish it up today by announcing the winners of the contest to win a copy of the 2006 American Road Racer calendar. Woohoo! Before we start all that, I do have an email from alert MotoGPOD listener Sean George, which, among some other things, Sean said this. He says, I noticed that you talk about Nicky Hayden with a huge amount of enthusiasm. This seems to be reflected in internet forums based in America as well as at the USGP. In Europe, or at least in the UK, folks seem to prefer Colin Edwards. Do you think this is because of the series that these guys raced in? We don't get AMA on terrestrial TV over here, whereas we saw Imola 2002, enough said. And by that, Sean's meaning Colin's amazing performance there at Imola. Or do you think it's a cultural thing, Sean continues on. Nicky is more rambunctious, which Americans seem to like, whereas Colin seems to have an air of quiet determination, which seems more English. Is it a combination of the two? What do you think? Well, Sean, first of all, that's kind of an interesting question. And I do apologize if I come across as a huge Nicky fan. I pretty much am a big fan of Nicky Hayden, but I try to be unbiased as possible, especially considering that about 45% of the MotoGP OD audience is not from the United States, so I don't want to be, you know, rah-rah USA and all that. But, you know, I've been following Nicky Hayden's career for quite a few years, and he is, you know, he's a good guy, and we all have our fans, so we all have our, you know, favorite racers, and I'm definitely a fan of his. But I will have to work on that and not try to come across as a huge Nicky Hayden fan. But to answer the question, at least a little bit, I think that judging from what I see in the forums over here, particularly the Speed TV forum at insider.speedtv.com and the Ride On 2 forum at rideon2.com, there's probably more Nicky Hayden fans, but there seems to be a huge amount of people that don't like him, you know, as well. So it's kind of like either or almost. But it's not really an exclusive thing, you know, where the people that like Nicky don't like Colin or vice versa. You know, but a lot of people do seem to have a preference one way or the other. And I mean, Colin has a fair share of fans too. A lot of fans you talk to about that, are big Colin fans, but it seems like there's kind of more Nicky Hayden fans. And it probably does have as much to do with the fact that Hayden is an AMA championship, winner, including in fact, he won the Supersport championship when he was like 16 years old and still in high school and, you know, just a young rising star that people have followed for a few years here, and that, you know, Edwards was doing World Superbike at the time, which is, you know, was more popular in Europe, but there are a large number of World Superbike fans over here as well. So I don't know. It could be Nicky's just charisma. Kind of not real sure about that. Both riders are very charismatic, but there's something about Nicky's, you know, sort of aw shucks kind of thing that he's got going on that does appeal to a lot of people, at least the ones that I know. But I'm curious about what other people think. So, you know, maybe we should put this one out to the listeners, not just Americans, but, you know, everybody, the international listeners, all of them, you know, Nicky and Colin, are you guys all out there? Are you fans of theirs or not? And why or why not? I'd really like to hear, send me some answers to MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. And, you know, maybe if I get some good stuff, I can talk about it a little bit more in another show and we'll kind of see if there is a reason of why it seems that Americans might be a bit more Nicky Hayden fans and Europeans might be a bit more Colin Edwards fans. Okay, now for some MotoGP news. Valentino Rossi comes to Valencia still trying to match Mick Doohan's record for wins in a single season. Valentino's got 11 victories so far, but his second place finish in Turkey a couple of weeks ago spoiled his chances to actually beat Mick Doohan's record, but he can still match it. He won here at Valencia last year, and he stands a real good chance of winning again, which would mean that he'd at least, you know, like I said, match Mick Doohan's record of 12 victories in the season, even though, you know, there's always going to be that asterisk. They had more races to do it in and so on and so forth. But he would match it. But, of course, Marco Melandri is going to want to get another victory to follow up his victory from Turkey. And then I'll bet Nicky Hayden is definitely would like to have another victory, too, to round out the season, maybe get two, continue this string of podiums that he's been doing on. And not to mention that all the Spanish riders are going to be going crazy pushing super hard to do well at this race. So said that Jibber Now and Carlos Checa are going to be way up front there. And Tony Elias has all of a sudden found a whole lot of something going on too. So we can expect to see him do real well here as well. It's going to be a great race here in Valencia. You know, even if, like I said, it is the last of the season, which is always sad. And I will have a race report on Monday. So definitely looking forward to this race. It's going to be a good one. And make sure you guys watch it. It's on Sunday on Speed TV in America and MotoGP.com everywhere and wherever you happen to watch MotoGP, wherever you are in the world right now. And in some other news, Yamaha has decided to adopt their traditional red, white, and black international livery for the motorcycles for the race at Valencia. You might remember that they used the traditional yellow and black U.S. livery at the U.S. GP in July. And so this kind of follows that same sort of decision where they're kind of going back for their 50th anniversary and celebrating their racing heritage and all that kind of thing. And there's some photos of the mics on MotoGP.com, not my MotoGPOD website, but the real MotoGP.com website. The bikes look really cool in the black and white and red. But I wonder if anything has, if any of this has anything to do with the rumored difficulties that Yamaha is having with their primary sponsor of Altadis, which is the maker of Galwa's and Fortuna cigarettes. Supposedly, you know, Rossi set off a big stink a few months ago because it's rumored that he'll be racing a non-Galwa-sponsored Yamaha next season. There was talk of it being the Italian beer Nastro Azzurro and, of all things, McDonald's, which, you know, McDonald's. But it would be cool to see, you know, companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola and so forth getting into MotoGP, and there's rumors of Coca-Cola being involved in Formula One. Not so much because it's great to have these companies in Formula One, but because they're American companies and you know, having them in MotoGP or Formula One might have some sort of indication of greater popularity here in America. So while that may not necessarily be the best thing internationally, it certainly is a cool thing for Americans. And so I'm kind of interested in that one. But anyway, I digress a little bit. Whether or not Rossi runs with McDonald's colors, you know, big yellow M on the side, or just Nastro Azzurro or whatever, it has been rumored that it's not going to be a tobacco brand, and that definitely set Altadis off. They did not like that at all. I haven't been able to hear anything about it for the last month or so, you know, I'm not sure what's going on in the rumor mill about that, and haven't heard anything official about what's going to happen next year, but it is a possibility. And also, Team KR has announced that they will race at Valencia, with Curtis Roberts returning to the team for the final round of the year. Curtis is Kenny Roberts Jr.'s younger brother. And so that's kind of good to see him. He was in MotoGP last year racing on the Team KR Proton bike. And they're going to be using that same Proton KR V5 motorcycle from last year. You might recall that KTM pulled the plug on the engines and money for Kenny Roberts' team a few months ago, leaving Team KR pretty much screwed. They raced at Brno in August with rider Jeremy McWilliams coming in for Shane Byrne due to these contract difficulties that all resulted from this whole KTM mess. But the team hasn't raced since Brno. Money is the big problem there. They just simply cannot afford the flyaway races, and not to mention that they don't even have an engine supplier, and that they're racing a motorcycle literally that was almost auctioned off in July. They got some testing time on it at Almeria, Curtis Roberts did, and they have high hopes for a decent performance this weekend, and it's real good to see him back, and hopefully this means that we'll see them next year. There were other rumors that I saw that they might possibly be running a Honda V5 engine in that same motorcycle next year, which, you know, that would be outstanding. But once again, you know, you see these rumors one place and then you never hear about it again. But the Proton bike, you know, has an interesting chassis. It's supposedly quite technically advanced and, you know, pretty trick and all of that. And it's not the chassis that's the problem. It's just, you know, power delivery. They just, they don't have a good, strong enough engine in there. So it would be kind of fun to see what would happen if they could put a, you know, one of the top runners in there, Honda V5 or the Yamaha 4 cylinder or something like that. But whatever, we'll have to see how that works out. And we'll have to see how Curtis Roberts works out this weekend. And then last but not least, we've got yet another substitute rider on the Camel Honda. Ryuichi Kinari will substitute for the injured Troy Bayliss this weekend because Bayliss failed to recover in time for the race. Which, yeah, right, sure, that is the reason. Although he did get a podium last year, Bayliss did, but it was on a Ducati. So maybe the Camel Honda did actually want him to race here. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think they've been falling all over themselves to make sure that Troy could come back. They seem to be more concerned about finding people that will ride for him. And in fact, Kinari is the third guy to step in for Bayliss. following Shane Byrne, who rode in Malaysia and Qatar, and then Christopher Mullen, who rode in Australia and Turkey in the last race. However, and it looked like Vermeulen was going to be racing here at Valencia, but he kind of dropped off the Honda Christmas card list when he signed for Suzuki for next year. And that shot down his RC211B ride for Valencia, definitely not on the Honda happy list. And apparently Honda, at least, you know, Camel Honda, felt that Chiari might be a better shot than Byrne. But in any event, it's going to be Ryuichi Chiari. And Chiari finished second overall in British Superbike this year, so he's, you know, he's a good rider. He should be more or less familiar with the RC211V because he rode for the Gresini team, you know, in Telefonica Movistar colors in 2003 when he joined the team to replace, after the death of Daijiro Kato at the season opener at Suzuka 2003. And he was teammate to Seiji Girmanow all that year. He did okay, you know, considering that was a sort of a tragic year for the team and it was his first year and everything like that. I don't think that a whole lot was expected of him, and he just delivered, and he did okay. So he should be able to do okay now at Valencia. Vermeulen did a real good job, considering that it was his first time on a MotoGP bike, so it's going to be kind of interesting to see how Chiari does in comparison. All right, we are at the last race of the season, like I've said several times so far this show. And that means no races for about 4.5 months till the 2006 season opener on March 26th at Jerez. But even if this is the last race of the season, it's going to be a really good one, and I'm definitely looking forward to watching it. The Ricardo Tormo circuit of Valencia packs a whole lot of corners into a small area, which means that the riders just really have to be, you know, Johnny on the spot in every turn. There's no long straightaway or something like that where they can try to make up some significant time. The front tire is very important because it needs to have good grip and turn the bike while under heavy braking into all these different tight corners. And then right away, the riders are going to be whacking open the throttle to get into the next corner. So the rear traction is also going to be very important. Finding that right combination of engine rideability and balance suspension and, of course, the good front and rear grip will be the key. So as usual, a good, strong, well-balanced bike is always the best way to go. And as at other circuits with a lot of hard braking areas, the front is going to be set slightly higher than usual with the rear slightly lower to try to eliminate the excessive dive under braking. But of course, this means that the rear end squat under acceleration becomes a problem, so that has to be taken care of without causing oversteer by or making the bike too prone to wheeling by, you know, excessively putting the back end lower and too much weight on the rear wheel. So what I'm going to do here is we're going to take another audio lap of the circuit. I got a few positive comments about the one that I did for the Istanbul race in Turkey a couple weeks ago, so I'm going to have another shot at it for Valencia. I'm actually going to watch an onboard video that I downloaded from MotoGP.com while I do this, so it's going to be in real time. Should take us about a minute and a half or so. Okay, we're coming on their front straightaway of the Ricardo Tormo circuit. This is the fastest section. We've got up into sixth gear. We just crossed the start-finish line. Now we're heavy on the brakes, going all the way down to second gear for the first turn one, a sharp 90-degree left-hander. We get down to second gear about 130 kilometers an hour. Then there's a little short straightaway section to turn two, which is another left-hander where we're going to get all the way down to first gear. And this is almost a hairpin here to this another short section and another left-hander that we're taking in second gear. And as we go down around to turn four, which is a second gear right-hander, leading into a double apex with turn five, also a right-hander, as we're going around it, all staying in second gear the whole time, never getting over about 110 kilometers an hour. Then we come up to turn six, that's a second gear left, and we're following it around. Now we're onto the back straight. We're going to get up into the gears a little bit. We take this left-hand kink in fourth gear and start downshifting quickly for turn eight, which is a second gear left-hander, leading us all the way around, nice long sweeping corner, leading through into turn 9, and now we're going in through turn 10, which is a first gear right-hander, once again almost somewhat of a hairpin, and this is going to lead us onto another short straightaway section where we can get up in the third gear, and then back heavy on the brakes, second gear down here for left-handed turn 12, and then we lead through the long sweeping turn 13, which is a left-hander that we're taking in third gear. And then back down, heavy on the brakes, down into second gear for the final turn, the off-camber turn 14, which leads us back onto the start-finish straight, as we'll get back up through the gears again, into fourth gear, fifth gear, across the start-finish line, and that completes our lap of the Ricardo Tormo circuit. Okay. I think that actually turned out pretty cool. Even though this is quite a tight track that you're packing a whole lot of corners into a small area, and it's really sort of more suited for the smaller bikes. I think the 250s and the 125s, you know, it's a very, very exciting race here with the MotoGP bikes. It's a bit stop and go, but, even then I still like it quite a bit. It looks like a good place to go see a race. And it's definitely, you know, one of these days that I want to do that. I want to go to a race in Valencia. It's got the highest attendance of any race on the calendar. They put on a really good show. It seems to be like just a fantastic place to have a motorcycle race. And so I kind of envy all the people that are going to be there. All about 120 odd thousand of them, I think, on race day is something like the attendance that they get at Valencia. All right, it's time for our Brian Drebber interview, part deux. We ran part one of this interview with Brian Drebber last week, and it turned out absolutely great. Brian and I ended up talking for so long on the phone that I ended up having to break it up into two parts. This wasn't just a trick to make you tune in again, but, you know, it did kind of work out nice that way. It was a really great interview. It went very, very well, and I appreciate it a lot. And for listeners who don't know who Brian Drebber is, he's a racing announcer, you know, primarily motorcycle racing. He was covering the AMA series here in the States on Speed TV. And it was recently announced that for some reason or another, some insane reason, he won't be announcing the AMA races next year. It's very unfortunate. We're going to miss Brian a lot. But he still will be involved with Speed TV in one capacity or another, and he's still going to be involved in motorcycles and motorcycle racing. The guy's a big bike nut. He's got a lot of motorcycles. And so I'm sure we're going to hear more from Brian Drebber. Certainly hope so, at least. In any case, why don't we get on with this? Jump right into part two of the interview.
So on MotoGP, I was going to ask if MotoGP, when they finally came back to Laguna Seca here just this last July, if that was the first MotoGP race that you announced. It kind of doesn't sound like that's the case, but was it?
Well, Freddie and I did quite a few we did a few 500 races and almost all of the 250 and 125 races for a couple of seasons, and I want to say that was perhaps 4 or 5 years ago. Okay. Now they've come to an agreement, Speed Channel and the European broadcasters and everybody involved, where they take voice and picture,
right,
because they have the technology to do that now.
Yeah.
It's still a little sketchy when they go to places like Qatar and some of these other, you know, for lack of a better phrase, kind of third world-ish countries, or at least countries where the technology may not be that readily available to get that high-speed data line for voice. And sometimes, to be quite honest, Bob, the voice comes from one place, the picture from another, and they have to match that up.
Oh, wow.
In the case, for instance, of the Formula One broadcasts on Speed Channel, the announce team is in Charlotte.
Right.
And the race is in Brazil.
Right.
So the pictures and the vroom vroom noises are coming from Brazil, and the announcers' voices are coming from Charlotte, and it's all being linked together. And how that works, every now and then you'll see someone speaking and the words don't quite sync up with their lips. Their lips are moving out of, it looks like a bad Japanese movie. That's because there's a problem.
Right.
There's a little timing problem, and that occurs. But most of the time they get it right, and we're not so beset with our own egos to realize that a lot of people simply watch with sound turned down.
Yeah, and the Formula One broadcast, when you mentioned that, that's that announcing team, and they sort of, you know, they Americanize it a little bit, and they have such a good rapport, and it's so enjoyable to watch, because quite frankly, from my point of view, Formula One is nothing like as interesting as MotoGP, but they do make a very good show, Bob Varsha and Steve Matchett and David Hobbs, and I'd love to see something like that with MotoGP, with, you know, with our guys like you and Freddie Spencer and so forth, and we get to watch the whole qualifying and all that. And I understand it's not likely to happen, but one of these days maybe it will, if we, you know, old Nicky Hayden gets better and we can build up an audience.
Well, you're certainly preaching to the choir with me. I would love to be a part of those broadcasts, but even if I wasn't, I would love to be a fan sitting at home with a bag of chips and a cold, frosty adult beverage next to me and be able to watch that from beginning to end. What a luxury it was when we were at Laguna and we had that ability.
Right.
Not everyone at home saw every practice and qualifying. We did a qualifying show, as you well know, but we saw every practice and qualifying and how it all went together and each and every little bit of drama that took place over the course of that entire weekend. And if were that a weekly were that a weekly thing, I'd love it. And were I if I was a part of it, I would love that even more.
Right, right. So, well, it's just an economics question. Maybe one of these days we'll MotoGP will have the fan base that's necessary for that to happen. That would be awesome.
Well, I think it was Malcolm Forbes who said the answer to 99 out of 100 questions is money.
Yep. Assuming that talking about MotoGP, assuming that it is the kind of the pinnacle of the motorcycle racing series, and that many of our riders in AMA or World Superbike or whatever would like to move up to MotoGP, and not knocking their careers, they look like they're having a lot of fun too. But assuming MotoGP is the pinnacle, who do you think in the American racing scene maybe is ready to move up or sort of deserves a ride in MotoGP?
Wow. The easy answer is all of them. The ones that have gotten to the top of the sport here.
Uh-huh.
The reality is that, well, I don't know. I mean, you have to think of when it looked like Roger Hayden, or even Tommy might get a shot. There was a little rumor that wound around to get a wild card shot a
right
while ago.
Phillip
you have
Island,
to think.
Yeah.
You have to think to yourself that a guy as young as Roger and as accomplished as he is, and it always becomes, unfortunately, it becomes a blend of age and experience, which are almost mutually exclusive. Everyone is looking for that up-and-coming kid, but they want that kid with experience. Well, how long ago do they have to start? We know that Raj, Tommy, and Nick all started when they were 4 or 5 years old in Earl's driveway. Well, that seems to be the case. You almost have to start that early to get the skill set necessary so that while you're still a young athlete, while you're still, 20 years old or in that area, you can move to the upper echelon of the sport and be competitive, like John Hopkins, given his travails with a somewhat uncompetitive machine. We know that Hopper's got the goods.
Right.
We know now that of course, Nicky had his naysayers for a while, but he's personally, I never lost faith in the fact that he had what it takes to be successful at that level. And when you look at a Valentino Rossi and how incredible his accomplishments have been over 7 championships, and you realize that he's still only 26, 25,
right.
I forgot.
26, I think.
26 years old. I mean, that's quite incredible. And that sort of talent and opportunity only comes along maybe once or twice in a lifetime or in a generation. But we've seen, a tremendous crop of talent that's already gone to MotoGP. We've seen a few that have been there and come back because of one reason or another. And Matt Mladen is constantly put up as a name that why isn't he in MotoGP? Well, he himself will tell you, number one, the opportunity that he had back in the day when he was that young up-and-coming rider was not the right opportunity. It takes a lot more than just talent on a motorcycle. It takes the right motorcycle and the right crew, et cetera, to be successful. And nowadays, Matt himself will tell you that if he could cut off a leg and lose 30 pounds, then he could be competitive. Otherwise, he needs 10 or 15 more horsepower than the other guy.
Yeah.
So it's a question of the package, not only on the motorcycle and of the motorcycle, but in the garage and in the testing and in the factory and where it's all designed. It's a tremendously complex formula. And to get back to your original question, who has what it takes, who might be the next ones? Certainly, if we look at this youth and accomplishment package that's already in place, you have to think about a guy like Roger, perhaps more than his brother Tommy, only because he's younger.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Spies instead of Matt Mladen. They're similar in size, but Ben is younger. Ben and he has a style and a certain amount of accomplishment that's put him where he is today. Beyond that, again, all of them, anyone who shows that they have what it takes should get an opportunity. One of the things that I'm a little concerned about with our sport is how there's kind of a glass ceiling, that things at the top tend to remain as they are. It's musical chairs, not only among the riders, but among the teams, that you have mostly the same faces, both behind the wrenches and behind the handlebars. They tend to just trade places, and they create kind of a glass ceiling at the top. Rarely does someone move on move completely away from the sport, or to a point where an opportunity presents itself in one of those factory trucks, in one of those top echelon teams in World Superbike or MotoGP, that the same faces tend to keep moving around. Am I wrong about that? I mean,
no,
occasionally a new face pops up, but mostly it's the same. It's business as usual.
Yeah, no, I agree, and that's a point. And you've got the factories on one hand don't want, you know, if they've got the choice of somebody that has this experience and is perfectly capable and as a rider is not too old or not too out of shape or what have you, then you know why would they want to go with this young unknown when they can grab Sete Gibernau from one team and bring him over to another and that sort of thing. And I do agree. And I mean, short of saying some sort of high year, 10-year program where, okay, you've been in the sport for 5 years, it's time for you to go out and let somebody else come up. I don't see how you're going to change it, to be honest.
It's difficult. And each new crop of riders simply has to prove itself against the standard that exists. And that, you know, here in AMA Superbike, obviously it's you have to beat Matt Mladen and Miguel Duhamel and people like that to prove your worth.
Right.
When you get to the world arena, you have to beat the Sete Gibernaus of the world and the Valentino Rossis and so on to get to be considered the best. And while it is a real conundrum on the part of the people who do the hiring, as little as I understand about this, what they want is that young and up and coming rider that they can groom in their own image and they can develop along with the motorcycle. But what they end up with most of the time, for lack of a better term, the devil you know versus one you don't.
Right.
You know what a Gibernau or a Caparossi or somebody like that is capable of, and it's just a question of creating the right chemistry with the machine and with the team in order to bring out the best in that proven rider,
yeah,
as opposed to taking a chance with a younger rider. And yes, that's the devil you don't know. You know enough about his skill or talent. Yes, the kid's fast, but does he have the mental capacity? Does he have the total package ability to succeed once the stakes are higher, once the power is higher, once the level of competition is higher? It's easy to get to that point, but to be successful in that environment takes a lot more.
Right, and a lot of it's the right place at the right time. You're also competing not against the young Americans in this series, but then you've got a whole crop of young people in all these other countries that are all moving up. The Japanese have the Honda Racing Scholarship Program, British Superbikes. I'm sure they'd love to see an English rider in GP. James Ellison and Shane Byrne are doing real well, but for what machines that they've been on. But to see a British guy on a top notch ride and everything, they feel that it's been a while. So it is a very difficult thing. And then when you say that you have this same sort of situation with the mechanics and the teams, because it is a team sport, and the guys that are successful have a team behind them. It's not just the guy going out there on the motorcycle.
There's no set recipe for success. It isn't like you can pull out a cookbook and say, add a teaspoon of that, a pinch of this, and 3 ounces of that, and you will produce a county fair award-winning shoe fly pie. It just doesn't happen that way. There are proven roads to success, but it still is so much about the chemistry of the many individuals that it takes to support the one individual whose job it is to go out there and bring the thing across the finish line first.
Right.
All of that is so important and so difficult to achieve. And I think that's what makes racing so fascinating, that it isn't always going to be the same as it ever was. Now, for instance, Valentino Rossi and Jerry Burgess have created an environment that transcended different manufacturers through the career that they've had at the highest level of the sport. Here in America, Matt Mladen and Reg O'Rourke and Pete Doyle and his little band of merry men have created the kind of chemistry that's resulted in repeatable results. And they obviously have it going on. But then invariably there's a variable that's inserted somewhere along the line, and either they have to readjust or someone else becomes successful in their place. That, I think, is what's so fascinating about the sport, not only from week to week, but from year to year.
Hmm. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense too. And I tend
every dog has his day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and there are there's Dorna has set up the MotoGP Young Riders thing, and so we're going to see more of that, and hopefully we can get, you know, from an American nationalistic point of view, that we'll start seeing some Americans in that series. And I've heard some rumors about people that, you know, young kids that are possibly ready to be moved in that direction, and it's just sort of a question of being in the right place at the right time, I guess, and then they can start building those.
Well, and I think that a number of riders have done it their own way. We know that Jason DeSalvo spent some time in Europe, and whether that's the reason for his success back here in the States or not is subject to debate, but clearly he did things a little different. Nicky Wimbauer is over there right now attempting to do the same thing and to try to make a slightly different path other than through the AMA as an American rider. And we've seen some of these programs over the years. In Formula One, they have the Red Bull driver search thing that went on for a couple of years and produced some success. We would all love for there to be a clear path to the top. If you do all the right things, you will get to the top of the sport.
Right.
But there is no clear path. And while it's my opinion that there are forces that try to create that, there are also forces who try to sort of keep it the same,
sure,
and protect their own kingdoms, and who wants to wake up every morning with some young kid nipping at your heels? Every morning there's another one after that, when all you're trying to do is stay out there and make a living. I feel that way in my business sometimes. I can understand how it is in an even more competitive environment such as racing itself. I mean, what we do is quite secondary to that, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, even in civilian jobs, you know, you have the same thing. There's always somebody that might be willing to do it, probably for less money, which, like you said, is often the answer.
I respect youth and enthusiasm, but I try to count on age and treachery myself.
There you go. Exactly. It'll outweigh youth enthusiasm most of the time.
Well, you don't want to make it easy for these kids, you know. You want to make sure that if you feel like you learned the hard way, that they need to do the same. And I think that there is no lesson better learned than one that involves a certain amount of work. And anyone who understands that hard work will be rewarded and that luck alone is not going to get it done.
No, yeah, but you, it built character. But and also, though, you do a lot of times, these people, you make your own luck. You know, you can put down, boy, so-and-so's had such bad luck this season because, you know, his motorcycle ran out of gas or his car, you know, was taken out by a backmarker, that sort of a thing. But how come the other guy didn't have that problem? And I'm not saying it's straightly so-and-so's fault. It's just sometimes you do make your own luck. That's just the way it is.
I agree 100%. I don't think there's any question. There is that sort of unknown quantity that we call luck, you know, that we call kismet or any number of other words that have been used. And indeed, sometimes those things just happen, and there's no explanation other than bad luck. You know, a 20-cent widget fails.
Yeah.
For no predictable reason, even though all of the service intervals were dutifully adhered to, that's luck. Or, you know, as you say, someone's taken out with an unfortunate circumstance. Yes, you can make a great deal of your own luck, but at times you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, hey, that's racing.
Right.
And move on.
Right. So you're saying there is no sort of, you know, fairy dust that they sprinkle on Rossi's tires or something like that? That's not how it works?
If there is, I'm sure he pulls it out of his own little pocket that he's devised with his own little secret formula, and it's Valentino Rossi himself that sprinkles the fairy dust on those tires. He has obviously he has all the best resources available to him, that if there is something that his team thinks can make a difference, they're going to make it available to him. But ultimately, the decision to use it or to apply it or to do whatever it is that's going to be done with it is his and his alone. Mm-hmm. I sympathize so much, and many of the mechanics and the crew guys in the paddock are the ones to whom I'm the closest, while we all honor and admire the riders for their God-given ability and the hard work that they've used to maximize their talent. It's that guy that slaves away for hours and hours in relative anonymity and back in the shop, and he builds this perfectly wonderful, amazing, beautiful motorcycle that every nut and bolt is tightened and indexed to just just so and all that. And then, and I've heard these guys say it this way, I have to give it to some hairball kid who's going to go out and throw it on the ground and think nothing of it.
Yeah, that must be very difficult.
Yeah, all of my hard work at some point is just handed over to somebody else. You know, this child that I've born, you know, and taken to term is now going to be thrust out into the world over which I have no control.
Yeah, that must
be
very traumatic. Okay, that was yeah, a really interesting sort of a whole situation about what we've talked about here. And I kind of lost my thread a little bit, and I apologize.
Well, I tend to do that to people, so no apology necessary. It's my fault entirely, I assure you.
No. And back to, real quick, back to AMA and the state of American road racing. We have the news that Pikes Peak International is closing and that the AMA won't be racing there in 2006, even though, you know, it was initially on the calendar, apparently. And I, you know, I have my own feelings on the subject. What do you think about that? How is that, you know, what did you say when you heard that's not going to happen?
As best I can understand it, it was one of those business decisions that occur at a much higher level than any of us have control over.
Oh, sure.
That the track was purchased and the new owners had a different plan, and that's certainly their right. And what you know, can they be forced to hold a race? Apparently not. What's going to happen in its stead? I don't know yet. Although we've seen this Sears Point, Infineon, its correct name, has announced that their schedule involves the AMA Superbike race on the weekend that was previously scheduled to be at Pikes Peak.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense on one hand, but to me, a lot of this is through the looking glass. And even though I'm interested, for instance, in all the silly season and the off season and the intrigue and subterfuge and drama and soap opera that goes on between the last race of the season and not even through the tire test at Daytona all the way to March, it's very often so difficult to get a handle on. It's through the looking glass, as I said. It's kind of, how can you possibly understand it? A, because we're not privy to all the information that went on to make these decisions. And B, even if we were, speaking for myself with a limited mental capacity, would I be able to understand it anyway? Probably not. So I simply accept it as it is. And
sure,
when it's time to go racing, I go racing. And if I'm not going to go, then there's obviously been a decision that I had nothing to do with it, that I just have to accept.
Right. Yeah. Understandable. In your case, and many of our viewers.
What I'm hearing is to address the subject in kind of a broader scope and even and more hypothetically, what I'm hearing is an idea that's been bandied around a little bit about going to some of the more successful tracks, shall we say, in terms of the promotion and the crowd and so on, going there more than once. If the Nextel Cup guys can go twice to Daytona or twice to Talladega, or they can pick tracks where they have multiple events, why shouldn't we be able to do that as well? Of course, in concert with the promoters and the track owners. The ones that come to mind, the more successful promotions, if you want to call them that, are the Mid-Ohio's, the Road Atlantas, the Barber Motorsports Park, even Elkhart, and not by coincidence, I'm pointing out natural road courses as opposed to going to the Fontanas and the Daytonas and the
Pikes Peak,
of course, has taken care of itself, to going to those places. But, you know, why can't we have a 15 to 20 weekend schedule by going more than once to most of the tracks? This is an idea that I understand is starting to take some legs.
I think it's a good one.
And that we may see that in the fairly near future.
Outstanding.
Two visits to Mid-Ohio, two visits to Road Atlanta, two visits to some of the more popular tracks, and, you know, spring and fall, separate them by a couple of months, do whatever it takes to make the schedule work. And
sure.
You'd all like to see more races, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to be careful. You don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg and everything. And you know, overkill, you attendance would start dropping off if you overdo it. But I think that two is definitely within the realm of possibility, particularly out in the West Coast. We, you know, the population density is not really here, so You know, when we do get a race out here, it's typically a longer drive, you know, or it's in Los Angeles where there is the population.
Well, that part of the country is also a lot bigger.
Right.
You know,
it takes
quite a while to get from Infineon to Pikes Peak, for instance. I drove that route, and it the other thing too about multiple visits to tracks and increasing the schedule is there becomes, I would have to imagine, a breakover point where the extra cost of visiting those tracks would, for the teams and,
right.
and for the competitors and for the organizers and for the AMA and for everybody else, because it's not getting any cheaper. The more popular and successful these promotions become, the more expensive it is, and out of proportion more expensive it is to return there. Hotel rooms, for instance, and restaurants, you know, when
yes.
you go to the races, you can buy a hotel room in Daytona the week before bike week, you know, for pennies on the dollar compared to what it costs you during bike week.
Right.
Or you know, everywhere, Road America, Mid-Ohio, all of the merchants. I mean, it's a capitalist country, last time I checked. And if the demand is up, the price is going to go up. But I mean, it really, really, really does hurt. It hurts. It's painful. For instance, at television production, we have probably 50 to 60 people on a given weekend that have to be transported, housed, fed, and all of that costs a lot of money.
Right.
A lot of money, even at the sort of bulk rates. And we have good, very good people that make those arrangements and organize them and try to get the discounts and things like that. But if you're on a per diem, for instance, or you're on a limited budget overall, when a hotel room goes from $79 a night to $150,
mm-hmm.
that's a big bite.
Sure.
And
yeah.
and the expense is going to certainly impinge upon our ability to increase the schedule at this point until there's more money altogether.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Which,
yeah.
by the way, is something I'm keenly interested in trying to help, is to bring more money into the sport as well, and
yeah.
to try to, I don't know, to see if I can't, I don't know, I just get people with money dancing around the campfire. You said it earlier, Formula One racing, yeah, it's interesting. MotoGP, now that's some stuff there.
Look, right.
It should be more popular than Formula One in America. But it isn't.
Yeah, and I agree. People
yeah.
tend to like what they can either maybe have done, which, you know, that's why baseball, football, basketball are all popular. The people played those in high school. Or they can see themselves doing. And, I mean, you know, a lot of people ride motorcycles. Not too many people drive an open-wheeled car. And if you just – and it's one thing I just do not understand is why doesn't everybody love this? But if you started seeing, and you to a certain extent we already are, the faces showing up in more mainstream advertising, like you may remember the Nicky Hayden commercial where he was riding the Goldwing, things like that, that would help. I mean, because, you know, you go to Europe, you go to the places where these are popular, or you look in America for NASCAR and for stick and ball sports, you see these athletes advertising all sorts of things that have very little to do with motorsport, you know, other than the fact that that company is a sponsor. And,
no question.
Right. So if we started seeing that, sorry.
Well, what I started to say, and I don't really, you know, we could beat this horse to death if it isn't already, and that is that I've long had the theory that we, as motorcycle enthusiasts and as the demographic that we represent, are very often our own worst enemies. On one hand, you have the typical NASCAR fan who is apparently more than content to sit in front of his or her television for 5 hours and watch. From the beginning, you know, from the pre-race show to the post-race show, 5 continuous hours of television. I challenge you to find almost anyone who's a motorcycle racing fan who even sits in front of their TV and watches the race when it airs. Almost everyone tapes it or TiVos it or something, and they go out and ride their motorcycle or climb a rock or walk in the park with their dogs or something. During the day, when it's nice outside, we are not couch potatoes as a group. We are not, you know, content to sit in front of our television and obediently watch every commercial and buy every product that these many, many athletes are endorsing across this broad spectrum of things we go out and buy. We tend to drive our own ratings down by not watching the shows when they're actually airing and watching them instead on TiVo or VCRs or at a sports bar with a group of our friends or at TWO up here in the North Georgia mountains where there's 75 guys watching the race, there's no Nielsen box attached to that television. We drive our own ratings down and create our own problem in terms of marketing the sport because we as the audience just aren't there to be
right.
counted.
Interesting.
It's difficult.
And- Yeah, one thing that fans can do with that, and I have done in the past, is send an email, make a phone call, write a letter, whatever, to these advertisers and tell them that you appreciate their support. And I, you know, and I've done that, and I think that advertisers, you know, pay attention to that sort of stuff. So I don't know if you think that's a good idea or not, but
Well, here's something that may shock you. I found it to be a little bit disconcerting at the very least, and that is that I was told that out of the however many thousand, and it's a relatively small number, 1,000 or 2,000, quote, Nielsen homes. And unfortunately, the television business is still driven by a very archaic rating system. We're not able to use the interactive technology that cable and satellite television provide to know what people are watching on a minute-to-minute basis because the Big Brother is watching you, ACLU, not to name anybody, but, you know, the rights of the individual have squash the ability to use that technology to get real ratings, what people are really watching, no matter when that is. So that's a problem. But what happens is also that it becomes, I don't know, I'm kind of losing the thread of my own argument itself here, but it's frustrating because people have their own individual habits. They watch what they want to watch when they watch it. It's the technology allows us to do that, but it doesn't allow us to report on ratings accurately. Right. And I was told that if one person who happened to be a Nielsen household for that week or 2 weeks or whenever it is, if that person went on vacation, left their television tuned to Speed Channel, it would double the ratings of every show on the network. If the ratings were doubled, the money would double, if not more. How cool is that?
That is, yeah. So if anybody out there is a Nielsen family, there's a little hint for you.
Leave yeah. your TV on, tune to Speed Channel, and go away. And then you will help the sport more than by, excuse me, bitching about how there's too much NASCAR on Speed.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't do any good.
No, unfortunately.
Watching the shows does good. Even if you're not really sitting there, turn the TV on, go out and ride your motorcycle, and pretend you're watching. It'll help.
Okay. All right, moving on. What do you ride for yourself? What's your primary motorcycle that you ride?
I ride mostly Honda V4s. I bought an Interceptor in 83, the first year of the Honda VF750F Interceptor. There was something about that bike that I had heard about, including Freddie Spencer's earliest testimonials about the bike. And when I purchased one, there was something about it that just talked to me. And it's the V4 engine configuration, frankly, that I'm attracted to. I just, you know, everybody has their own favorites. There's Boxer Beamer guys, there's, you know, V-twin guys, et cetera. I'm a V4 guy. And to that end, I have a few of them. And I'd like to think that in the V4 family, which started in 83 with that VF750F and continued all the way through the RC45, and now with the VFR 800 and the new VTEC VFR, I have from oldest to newest an 83 VF750F and a 98 VFR 800, both of which I ride on a fairly regular basis. I have a few in between, including a couple of RC30s. I'm two of the privileged few. And I also have, and these bikes are so much fun, two of the little 400 VFRs or RVF. I have the NC30 and the NC35. They're 400cc gray market non-import bikes, and they are just a hoot to ride up in the mountains. Yeah, 70. You never had so much fun with 70 horsepower. And,
sure.
You know, they're light and they're nimble, and that's what I ride. Beyond that, you know, extending away from the V4 family, I have a rather eclectic collection of little old bikes, the oldest being a 1965 Honda Dream 150, all the way up to well, I call it the Frankenwing, and we could do an entire half-hour show on that bike, but it's a Goldwing, essentially, that started its life as a Valkyrie, and if that hasn't intrigued you enough.
Yeah, morphed into a Goldwing.
So everything from a 50cc Honda Express, which is a little two-stroke moped, essentially, to a 1500cc Goldwing and kind of everything in between with the emphasis on Honda V4s.
Outstanding. So you're quite the motorcycle guy. That's cool.
Since before birth, a story that I've told quite often, my dad was in the military stationed on Guam. My mom got a job with the Navy. Shortly after they arrived, my dad organized it for his aerial Red Hunter to be delivered from Long Island to Guam. And the day it arrived, they took a moonlight ride up to the high point of the island. And as the story goes, on the way back from that moonlight ride, there were three of us.
Wow. It's quite a good story. Well, all right.
I like it.
Yeah. I appreciate having you on the show. I think the listeners are going to enjoy it a lot, or will have enjoyed it a lot by the time they've heard this. And, thank you very much. It was really a pleasure.
Bob, I talk for a living. I talk for a living, and I thank you for the opportunity to practice a little bit.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, that's going to do it for today. I hope you enjoyed the second part of that interview with Brian Drebber. I thought it went real well. I got a lot of positive feedback about the first part. I really want to say thank you very much again to Brian for being on the show. It was really good stuff. Enjoyed it a lot. We do have one last thing to do. It's kind of a fun thing, and that's we're going to announce the winners for the calendar contest. This is from the last show. All you had to do was send an email to contest@motogpod.com, and then you would be entered to win one of two copies that I'm giving away of the really, really cool 2006 American Road Racer calendar. Thanks to Mark Sorensen for helping me out with this so we could do this giveaway. So we're going to give a couple copies of these away. I got a whole lot of entries, more than I actually expected, really, which is really cool. And I did not reply to every email, personally, which is what I do with most emails that are just a MotoGPOD@MotoGPD.com. But I did read them all, and I wanted to say thank you very much for all the nice comments and stuff that people said and so forth. You guys are great out there. I really appreciate it. It's kind of cool. A lot of the emails said things like, pick me. But the contest was totally random, I assure you. I made a little Excel spreadsheet, kind of a randomizer, and just let it do the work. So our two winners picked at random are, drum roll please, John Owen, a.k.a. Johnny O, and Sam Migliori. All right. Congratulations, guys. I'm going to send you guys an email as well. And John, I'll need your address. Sam included his in his contest entry, but he did not. So I'll mention that in the email. And we'll get those calendars out and enjoy them very much. And thank you, everybody else, for sending in the entries. That was awesome. And like I said, I do appreciate all the nice comments and so forth. That contest was fun. Hopefully, we're going to be able to do some more in the future. Keep looking for them. Keep listening to MotoGPOD. And like I said, I will have a race report for Valencia here on Monday. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much for downloading it. And I will talk to you later. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.